From KUAR News in Little Rock, this is a look at Arkansas news, politics, and more. Coming up.
Several new state laws took effect this week.
One that could end up with a court challenge banned cities and counties from enforcing anti-discrimination ordinances.
Giving away adopted children to non-relatives without state involvement is now a felony. It was prompted by a molestation case involving a state lawmaker's family.
A couple of task forces called by the governor are busy.
In the coming week, we're expecting one to finalize recommendations on the future of Common Core educational standards.
Another is looking at how to expand computer science education.
And amid the uproar over the Confederate flag around the nation, thoughts about Civil War monuments in Arkansas.
That's on this week's edition of KUAR's Week in Review. And thanks for joining us. I'm Michael Hiplin.
I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotacek.
I'm Chris Hickey.
And I'm Jacob Kaufman.
Cities around the state, as well as Pulaski County, have been passing ordinances that prohibit discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity. But on Wednesday, a new state law took effect that prohibits them and basically stops the ability to enforce those laws. But it does seem like a challenge to this may be coming, in particular from Eureka Springs, where city leaders say they will continue enforcing a measure that bans discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity citywide, including businesses. This law was sponsored during this past legislative session by Republican Senator Bart Hester of Cave City, who said uniformity is needed across the state. And he also expressed doubts that Eureka Springs will actually challenge this new state law. Here's what he said.
I think the first time the city tries to enforce it on someone, the city opens themselves up to a huge lawsuit on an individual or a business, and they know that. I think they will probably keep the ordinance on their books as some sort of, you know, ceremonial type deal, but there is no chance they're going to enforce it.
But the city councilman who sponsored this ordinance says that indeed they will continue to enforce this. James DeVito runs a restaurant in Eureka Springs, serves there on the city council, and he says based on the city's discussions with city attorneys in Little Rock and Fayetteville, he believes that such local measures are legal.
There had been a recent municipal league conference just a couple of weeks ago where a lot of the attorneys were just talking about it and felt like, you know, there's so many gray areas that it's probably going to end up in a court of law before we'll be able to determine conclusively, you know, what Arkansas law says.
So it seems that both sides here, at least the two I spoke with, seem to agree that this is destined to end up in a courtroom.
Michael, can you tell us a little bit about why Eureka Springs is making the case that they can enforce this law? There are a number of other cities. Eureka Springs is not alone. And I think they're getting their argument a lot from Little Rock City Attorney. Little Rock has a less expansive city ordinance about this.
Yeah, and Eureka Springs' law does go further than, say, Little Rock or Pulaski County and most of the other cities. We've had several that have passed these kind of ordinances. The others have pretty much been impacting city employees, hiring, that kind of thing, as well as contractors with the city. Whereas Eureka Springs, this could impact private businesses, pretty much anyone in the city. But this is basically being based on the belief that this law, the way it was written, and in fact, DeVito says that state lawmakers erred in how they wrote this. They said that it only had to be based on state law, which is pretty broad. If they had specifically identified this as the state civil rights law, then that might be correct, that the new law going into effect would indeed prohibit this. But if you just say state law, well, there is protection from discrimination, from sexual orientation or gender identity, based on one anti-bullying law, which does specifically include that in the language. So if you include all state laws, then this very well may be something that the courts will have to decide because it wasn't spelled out by the legislature in this bill that was passed this year.
Michael, I have the language of that that section, a county, municipality, or other political subdivision of the state shall not adopt or enforce an ordinance, resolution, rule, or policy that creates a protected classification or prohibits discrimination on a basis not contained in state law. This section does not apply to a rule or policy that pertains only to employees of a county, municipality, or other political subdivision. So that's pretty broad. Any state law that uses a sexual orientation as a class of discrimination would make this an irrelevant law.
And it's also interesting, the timing of this law coming into effect in Arkansas is the same week when legislation was planned to be introduced federally that would address some of these workplace and housing and accommodation discrimination issues.
And there's also the issue that, you know, now that it's in effect, we saw in the months leading up to this, the 90-day period since the law was first passed, a few different cities try to pass discrimination ordinances. And that was because the legislature failed to pass an emergency clause that would have put the law in effect immediately when it was passed. And so there was kind of a rush. Yeah, a rush, or like some attempt to kind of passively, challenge some specifics of the law and make it a little more legally complicated as to, you know, whether those anti-discrimination ordinances were, you know, legal in the eyes
of
the law.
Yeah, and it kind of just served as a statement in general about human sexuality. It's the same summer that we ended up seeing same-sex marriage be legalized. So it's a statement from some of the more liberal cities that were worried it might affect, I guess, the people that live there who tend to be more open-minded on these sorts of issues, but also commerce, of course, came to mind in all of these battles.
And also worth noting that this new state law isn't deterring Fayetteville from considering, again, an anti-discrimination law. You did have a law passed last fall, then voters opted to repeal that law. Now you have it again coming up by city leaders in Fayetteville. So it seems like this will be ongoing and very likely could be a matter that judges will have to decide.
Interestingly, though, while the Human Rights Campaign has said that LGBT people in Arkansas face relatively much higher discrimination than other parts of the country, I don't think we've heard many instances of these laws being utilized.
And are we seeing much support here for the federal legislation that's been talked about? It's pretty much been Democrats in Congress who have been pushing this, as well as the Human Rights Campaign. But any word has there been? Obviously, this is just getting started in the process. But any indication so far whether this will have support?
I haven't heard anyone volunteer anyway their position that they'd be for this or necessarily say they're against it. But it's clear that all six of our Republican congressmen are generally opposed to same-sex marriage. They think it's sinful in general, so it's hard to believe that they might endorse something like this. And the argument for this wasn't about religion from Bart Hester originally. He said, I believe it's even titled something to the effect of Interstate Commerce Act. So, but I'm sure that they will have to say something about it in the future, and it'll probably be a campaign issue for the 2016 presidential election as well.
Yeah, said it would be challenging for businesses wanting to move to an area if every region had its own rules, but that
it turned out the opposite. Businesses seemed like that they objected to where they thought discrimination would be allowed.
Yeah.
It's interesting that there was such a national outcry over the Religious Freedom Restoration Act that would have given private businesses the power of government entities in claiming religious beliefs as a reason to potentially discriminate, whereas this law had much wider reaching impacts in some ways in terms of regulating the county's ability to pass their own rules. And it's interesting that it seems to be playing out on a sort of a symbolic level, and that there haven't been legal disputes where people are actively seeking to use these benefits, and as far as I know, but yet the conversation seems to be centered around sort of the symbolic value of the ordinances.
And the legal disputes are, we think, I mean, will come up with, as you said, the actual cities themselves being at the center of any potential litigation. I mean, we have Fayetteville, for instance, that has a vote planned in September, I believe, where they're going to put up for a vote a similar anti-discrimination ordinance. that voters repealed last year, and that seems to be an open defiance of this law, too.
Well, Jacob, another law that went into effect this week, this one without as much controversy, would make it illegal the practice known as rehoming, a phrase that most people had never heard of up until a couple of months ago. Talk a little bit about this and give the background as well with State Representative Justin Harrison. What led to this?
Yeah, I think the specter of all this just shocked a lot of people in a lot of ways, and I think that's part of why there wasn't much resistance to it, even though it's an issue that had been silently in Arkansas since Arkansas's existence, I suppose. But State Representative Justin Harris of Northwest Arkansas, he adopted two young daughters, and he ended up giving them away to a family friend and family employee because he felt he couldn't manage them. He couldn't be an effective parent to them. He felt that they were threatening his family in some way. And all this was totally legal. If you adopted someone from DHS, you could give them away to someone else, a non-relative, and it was totally legal without any state supervision or involvement. And this story got picked up by the Arkansas Times when they linked not only that these girls were given away to a family friend by a state representative, but this family friend and employee later turned out to have sexually molested several girls, including one, if not both, of those daughters. But I spoke with Representative Greg Letting. He was the author of two bills that addressed this. One, the primary bill by David Meeks, made it a felony. So we have a state legislator right now who's a sitting state legislator who he would have committed a felony if this law was in existence at the time. But Greg Letting explains his bills a little bit, and they mostly have to do with addressing the payments to families that gets state money for adoption and help post-adoption services so that hopefully no one would ever feel compelled to rehome their adopted children.
The issue came to the legislature's attention very late in the session. There are actually only 4 days left to file legislation. We all felt as though it was something we absolutely needed to address. So I was the first one to file something. Representative David Meeks followed suit. The two of us got together with Governor Hutchinson and DHS to figure out what we needed to do and what we could responsibly do in such a short period of time. We hammered out a couple of bills and fortunately received no opposition and were able to get them passed before the end of session. But both Representative Meeks and I and other legislators do anticipate there perhaps being further work that needs to be done on this issue in a future session.
And Representative Letting, a Democrat from Fayetteville, he chose not to mention Justin Harris's name specifically at all, and he didn't. It was never really brought up that much as legislators were unanimously passing these laws. They really tried to keep him out of the limelight. Despite some of them claiming to have knowledge about it beforehand, they still were all very surprised by this news.
Yeah, and I remember talking to Representative Letting shortly after he filed that bill at the Capitol. And it was interesting, like you said, I mean, there was only 4 or 5 days before the bill filing deadline was to come about. And he told me, like, you know, he had read that article by the Arkansas Times, like, when it came out that night he had gotten on the phone with his drafting attorney to come up with something. And a couple days later, he filed the bill. And he told me, and David Meeks as well, I spoke to, they both, neither of them had heard of this issue of rehoming. And it was really a revelation to a lot of people in the legislature. And it really became a bipartisan effort. You know, as, you know, Letting is a Democrat, Meeks is a Republican. I think Missy Irvin was a co-sponsor in the Senate. She's a Republican. And it passed overwhelmingly. And even David Meeks, who I believe told me he's a foster parent, they take in foster children, was unaware of this problem.
I think that Representative Justin Harris, he was on two committees that had oversight over DHS, which he resigned from, but he has said he's not going to run again and actually supported this bill, said he would be in support of making rehoming illegal, while he also pointed the finger at DHS somewhat when this came out and said that he felt that they hadn't offered his family adequate support and that he had been afraid that if he had gone to them about wanting to, you know, get help with these girls, that his custody of his own children might be threatened. The complications with those girls were very complex. They had a history of sexual abuse and the Harrises were almost frightened of the girls. And so there was some very fraught relationships there that apparently the Harrises couldn't really handle the situation, and seemingly DHS should have been a partner, and they weren't a presence. So, you know, another outcome of this whole string of revelatory information is that the governor called for an investigation into DHS, and last week announced that he's allotting $8 million to support the foster care system. And that there's now a series of recommendations for improving the DHS. So this is all sort of fallout from the Harris story. It's unclear if those holes there have really been filled.
Yeah, it is interesting, though. The problems with adoption and child welfare go far beyond rehoming.
Well, another issue, of course, was that Cecile Blücher in the Division of Family Services possibly had fast-tracked this adoption in the first place for the Harrises. And there were some questions about whether they were really qualified to handle these girls, given that they had two young boys.
Yeah, and there's some reporting had questioned Harris's role as the vice chairman of the Child Welfare and Labor Committee. Is that
about? Sounds close.
Which he did step down.
He did eventually. Yeah, exactly. But while he was in that role, yeah, in Youth Services, basically the legislative House committee that oversees many issues in DHS, whether or not he used his influence or used his position to influence Cecile Blücher and other higher up officials at DHS to speed along that adoption process.
Well, as you mentioned, the report came along with recommendations for improving DHS, increasing caseworker staff by 200, allocating an additional $8 million for improving the process for approving foster parents. How quickly is this taking effect or being implemented?
The legislature has to approve those funds, so I don't think it's going to take effect.
Yeah, some of these recommendations, I think they're 11. Yeah, they require some further action.
Well, Chris, this coming week we're expecting some big news. There are several task forces that are working on a number of issues. Governor Asa Hutchinson really has been big on when there are big challenges facing him. He calls a task force, and they study and make recommendations. Well, Common Core has been a big controversy, and after some 40 hours of hearings, as well as I think 9 meetings around the state, on Thursday we're expecting a final set of recommendations to come out of this. You spoke with Lieutenant Governor Tim Griffin, who has been leading this. What's in the works?
Yeah, well, that task force, they call it a council, the Common Core Council. The governor announced earlier this year in March, composed of 16 members, chaired by Lieutenant Governor Tim Griffin. When I spoke to him, they've been, as you said, conducting hearings all over the state and here in the Capitol, with educators, citizens, policymakers, et cetera, to kind of come up with recommendations for the governor to implement new policy and to see what the status is of the standards themselves, what needs to be done, et cetera, et cetera. Griffin said that the council should be meeting next week, next Thursday, to sort of finalize the recommendations, put all of them to paper, and submit them to the governor. And obviously, in education policy in the state, there are a number of actors. There's, you know, the legislature, the State Board of Education, there are local school districts around the state, and the governor as well, all influence education policy. But Griffin emphasized that these recommendations are for the governor.
So the governor will have to decide what he wants to do with that advice. And that's his prerogative. The board is created by the legislature and the governor. And, you know, they'll have to wait and see what the governor recommends. I hope that they will be persuaded or certainly take our recommendations into consideration. But ultimately, we were created by the governor for his benefit, to give him advice so he can make a decision.
And you'll have to excuse, I caught him at the airport. You can kind of hear the thud of baggage on the baggage claim going down. But he also spoke about the possibility for new legislation.
There were some issues relating to privacy and data privacy that I thought if we were going to deal with them properly, they would probably require legislation. There may well be some recommendations that would require legislation. Whether that legislation is pursued, that's up to the governor, that's up to the legislature.
So we'll see next week what comes about of this. But I mean, several of us have been covering this. Sarah, you've attended a few of these Common Core Council meetings. I mean, they've been long and involved, and lots of stuff has been discussed.
I hate to read too much into the tone of voice of the Lieutenant Governor, but I'm going to try, I guess. So it seemed in the past that any time, at least with the recommendation to change the year-end assessment tied to Common Core to the ACT, which the governor had some trouble doing, eventually did, Tim Griffin was very confident, saying, you know, these are the recommendations that we have for the governor, and they're going to become the law. You know, it's kind of a courtesy that we're checking in with the Department of Education or legislators. But this time seemed like he stressed a very different thing, saying the Common Core Task Force is a little bit more separate from the governor, even though the governor appointed everyone on the task force, and saying, well, we'll see if it gets picked up. We'll see what becomes of the recommendations. In the past, it seemed a little bit more forceful, like the recommendations would come to fruition.
Sarah, for you covering the hearings, what did you take away? What did you get any sense of kind of what direction they might be going? Each one of these hearings focused on a different topic of education.
Right. The focus of the hearings was math, English curriculum, the testing issues surrounding privacy and data, and then the assessment question. And, you know, Arkansas teachers, there's a University of Arkansas study shows that Arkansas teachers are in favor of Common Core and think that it helps them teach students better. The standards focus on original research in English and evidence-based writing. And in math, there's something called what the opponents call constructivist approach, which is about understanding the meaning of every step in the process instead of following a rote formula. And so some of the opposition has centered around people who believe that kids developmentally can't understand why they're doing what they're doing and they need to just know what to do and that this is going to be disastrous. And by and large, it seems that the state has adopted the standards with relative ease. And so I think that the tweaking might come down to some of those level issues. And, you know, my understanding of the data privacy questions that they largely centered around the PARC test and where that testing data was going to be housed and how the assessment provider would handle the access to that data. So I'm not sure what legislation would do in that regard. Chris, do you know?
Yeah, he was kind of short on specifics, but as we know, you know, the state board, after the makeup of the State Board of Education was altered by the governor with three new appointments, they declined to renew the PARC test or switch to the ACT Aspire test, which would, I guess, make those data privacy issues a little murkier. I don't know. He didn't give any specifics as to what would be recommended to change as far as those privacy issues go. But I guess we'll have to see when the report comes out.
Jacob, as to what you're saying, it's been interesting to me to watch the governor appoint commissioner of education, new members of the state board, and along with the lieutenant governor to this task force. So he has various bodies all engaging in the different steps of approving this testing change, ultimately, you know, all immediately appointed by him. And then, of course, because he's a new governor, he had the ability to actually cancel the PARC contract himself. It's been an interesting politically to watch the decision-making happen when it seems that it's really coming from one source.
Yeah, there is that effort to seem, I guess, because it's hard to know if people are going to like the recommendations of the task force, even though most educators, as you're saying, support it. It's still a divisive issue, especially, I think, within the Republican Party. So he's trying to have it both ways in some degree so he can say, well, that comes from the task force, not necessarily from me. But as you mentioned, he has a lot of sway over every aspect of this.
And it has seemed like, I don't want to read too much into everything, yeah, but it doesn't necessarily seem like they're just going to completely do away with Common Core. There has been some effort to find possibly ways that this might work, despite, as you mentioned, the outrage, especially from Republicans, going back to the whole federal government and states' rights issue that's often brought up.
Well, when Lieutenant Governor Tim Griffin first told lawmakers that they were recommending that first recommendation to switch the year-end assessment, he made a lot of comments that suggested that the problems people might have with Common Core, associate with Common Core, are really just about that park test, and that people kind of have conflated the two. And so if that is the case, and they change the test, maybe they are leaning towards keeping Common Core. They did pick another year-end assessment, at least tied in some way to Common Core.
Well, Oklahoma actually completely got rid of Common Core, and Tennessee is reassessing the use of Common Core. That's been a pattern in southern states, this backlash against it. And I've heard speculation that that's part of the reason why the park test maybe was a target of some of that criticism of sort of the federal overreach or coming to terms with a national standard. It's still unclear, based on everyone I've talked to, frankly, what the real issue with the park test
was. Well, Sarah,
was.
Do you want to make a prediction, and we'll find out next podcast if you're a good reporter or not?
Well, I think they'll keep the Common Core. I mean, that seems obvious to me, but yeah.
All Chris, right. any you want to wager anything?
No, I don't want to risk it.
And Jacob?
I'll risk my reputation. They're going to keep Common Core.
Okay. Well, we'll find out a week from now. And Sarah, another educational matter, where the governor has appointed a group to look at, has been expanding computer science education. This was something, a key goal that he brought up when he was campaigning for governor, to expand computer science education into all Arkansas public high schools.
So the legislature passed, what he wanted was a high school computer science course for every school. Every student could take the class, and that passed the legislature. So he has set up a task force to implement that process. Teachers have to be trained and to review the computer science curriculum in the state, which the Department of Education just updated. And the task force has a September deadline to issue recommendations, but they've come up with a few preliminary ideas in their committee breakdown that teachers should be reimbursed for earning college credits in computer science, a loan forgiveness program for students in computer science careers, a 3-hour computer science course for elementary and younger students. They discussed this week that, oddly, fourth graders are still learning typing formally in school, although most kids at that point, given the devices they use, can type if they have access to those. So it seems a little anomalous to have the typing skills come at such a late stage when we want high schoolers to be able to be coding. And then a creation of school and college internship programs with businesses and tax-free or reduced tax incentives to promote coding, to promote industry to come to the state, and also competitions to encourage students. So the governor's been courting tech firms around the country in Silicon Valley. He's discussed this, and the lieutenant governor ran on a job readiness platform also that, the Arkansas workforce could really benefit by coding, which isn't a geographically based skill, that those information technology industries might be the future given the state of manufacturing here. And this is an effort to put the infrastructure in place for education.
What are the biggest challenges to meeting these goals?
I think one right now that the committee is grappling with is teachers trained to teach all these courses. They discuss some issues with getting teachers certified. Some even AP teachers who've already teaching computer science have to take certain tests and have certain skill sets to qualify to teach these new classes that, oddly, they don't exactly always have, even if they are teaching the subject matter, because of the specifications of the new class. So I think they said there were four different computer science classes that could be taught at the high school level, but that requires a lot of investment in teachers, and area community colleges have already been offering training programs. So that's a big effort. And then the other thing that the task force is concerned about is how to get kids to want to do this, how to get the word out, and how to start them early enough so they're prepared to be at the high school level, making falling in love with coding and deciding to become computer scientists.
Yeah, how do you motivate them?
Well, I one time shadowed a class at Central High School, a coding class, actually, before coding was required, and The kids that liked it were trying to make video games, of course. But it is kind of interesting. The governor is in high school, especially, is trying to push education away from, I guess, your general education or arts education to skills education. And so whether that's high tech skills through coding, or he also has a big emphasis on workforce development through things like VOTEC programs that he wants introduced at the high school level, and maybe you finish up at community college after that. So it's pretty neat that there is that high-tech push with things like Little Rock's Creative Quarter, the Venture Center, the Innovation Hub, but also at the same time that push in high school for welding and carpentry and things like that.
Well, interestingly, Common Core also, you know, came out of the national recession when business leaders were giving feedback to educators that students weren't coming out of colleges and high schools prepared to be good at their jobs, and they didn't have the right skills. And so this has been a whole national shift towards valuing preparation in a different way that we're seeing now in Arkansas.
Well, finally, Jacob, amid the uproar over the Confederate flag, all stemming from the massacre at a church in Charleston, South Carolina, we've seen the Confederate flag brought down at the state capitol there in South Carolina. And it's just sparked an intense debate about how this country, and particularly the South, looks at relics of the Confederacy. You did a look this week at monuments around Arkansas and at our state capital to the Civil War.
Yeah, and I think it's important to remember that, you know, why people are looking at these symbols in particular. It's not just the Dillon Roof shooting and that historic African-American church in South Carolina. But it's because of the wave this summer of different police brutality episodes, the rise of things like the Black Lives Matter movement, the rise of talking about income inequality and things like that based on race. So the flag is one extension of those things. And if you're concerned about the Confederate flag, I think most people who are would naturally also be concerned about other Confederate symbolism, which tends to mean things like monuments. And that can be monuments to specific people or just generally to soldiers and things like that. And like Arkansas, like other southern states, there's hundreds of them throughout the state, mostly at county courthouses and things like that. But I spoke with Dr. Carl Moneyhon, who's written a few books about Arkansas and Texas, his time in the Civil War and Reconstruction. And he really says that with the rise of these monuments in the 1880s and 1930s, it really presented a new dynamic about how people remembered the Civil War time and kind of distorted or warped people's historical memory by leaving out certain groups of people.
Arkansas is a divided state in 1860. It's one of the last states to leave the Union. There's a real division within Arkansas. Arkansas per capita, I guess Tennessee produces the most Union soldiers of any southern state. Per capita, Arkansas probably produces more Union soldiers. But part of the reunion is that Union participation simply disappears from the history pages. I can't explain that. I don't know exactly how that happens or why it happens. One of the things that happens is a frontier state, as a part of this reunification, becomes a Confederate state, and the Union heritage simply disappears.
At the same time, when Moneyhon says that this reemergence kind of glorifies only one particular part of Southern society, that would be the white Confederate society, he said at the same time that way of honoring them actually paradoxically helped bring the South back into the fold as one nation by letting them sort of have a relief valve for those kind of feelings. But I guess generally the question behind all this stuff is some people could say it's erasing history, but other people would say, well, it's not erasing history so much as the history we're being presented isn't accurate at all. And so I spoke to a few different people, the state NAACP, and a representative behind this failed effort to separate Robert E. Lee Day and Martin Luther King Jr. Day. And those two members of the black community are opposed to these monuments. They find them offensive. They don't think anything's going to happen to them, although there are efforts in other states that have gained a lot of steam in terms of removing these really high-profile type of monuments.
And talk a little about what monuments are on the Capitol grounds, because I don't think the most people realize what all is there.
There's two monuments to various Confederate things on the Capitol grounds. They're both some of the biggest monuments on the Capitol grounds and on the front lawn at corners that are more prominently displayed maybe than other ones. One's to the women of the Confederacy. It's got a woman and her two children. saying goodbye to their family member who's a Confederate soldier as he goes off to war. And it's one of them has the it's maybe a toddler who's got like a drum of war, and there's a plaque on it that says something symbolic like the sons will emulate the deeds of their sires. So it's a message from the United Daughters of the Confederacy in around 1930 saying we want our children to grow up emulating this belief system, this value system. And the other one's to the soldiers of the Confederacy. And there's a, you know, 15-foot-tall soldier maybe who's holding a Confederate battle flag. And so some people say not monuments, but just the flag. Well, this isn't this one interesting? It's a monument with a flag. And that one, it says something on it where it says, our furled banner wreathed with glory, we adore it. And it underlines, we adore it. So it's very clear that it's an explicit endorsement, not only of just the people of that time who might have suffered, but also the Confederate cause.
And of course, on the Capitol grounds, not far away, you've got the statues to the Little Rock Nine with their school books. You know, to a degree, the grounds reflect our history.
Yeah, and that's one argument that a lot of people make, that it's not totally unbalanced, saying we only have white history, there's also black history. But both Fred Love and Dale Charles, the head of the state's NAACP, found it offensive that they would you could see both of them at the same time, much as some people might be offended that Robert E. Lee shares the same day with Martin Luther King Jr. Day. They see the Little Rock Nine not necessarily as only a monument towards African Americans, but as a monument towards a better society that everyone gets to be integrated with each other, when it's hard to say that the Confederate soldiers were for anyone but white Confederates.
And you mentioned the recognition of Robert E. Lee on the same day as Martin Luther King, the federal holiday, but there's also talk of perhaps changing that in the future. This may finally, after much talk before this incident in the last few years, that there might actually be a change there.
Yeah, and that's the major symbolic thing in Arkansas. While Memphis is trying to exhume the body of Nathaniel Bedford Forrest from a city park and topple a statue there, and in Georgia they're talking about changing Stone Mountain, which has Jefferson Davis, Robert E. Lee, and Stonewall Jackson, kind of like a Mount Rushmore figure. There's some calls to get rid of that.
Yeah, sandblast just completely blew it away.
And Atlanta's city council actually voted to instead maybe include some other people on there, like Martin Luther King Jr., to try to diversify it that way. But even though that's the major symbolic battle, I spoke with Nate Bell, who was a Republican at the time, now an independent, who tried multiple times despite clear opposition to this. He said, you know what, I want to try it again. I don't think there's any more momentum than there was before. But Fred Love, who was his co-sponsor at that, said, well, I'm going to try it every year until I'm not in office anymore. So we'll have that battle, it looks like, in the future, but who knows if it'll gain any traction.
Well, we'll see. And with that, that's it. Thank you for listening. This has been KUAR's Weekend Review, a look back at the previous week in news, politics, and more. I'm Michael Hiplin.
I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotacek.
I'm Chris Hickey.
And I'm Jacob Kaufman.
You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes if you're not already. Our music is by Chris Hickey. Thanks for listening.